nephew scooped me behind him. The man pulled himself gracefully away from the tree's rough trunk and strolled toward us. The fact that he was a vampire was now confirmed by his unnaturally white skin and huge dark eyes, emphasized by his black leather jacket, jeans, and boots. This vampire didn't care who knew he was different. His wolfish expression was the only imperfection in an otherwise angelic face, with symmetrical features and dark hair worn curling low onto his collar. He was smaller and slighter than Matthew, but the power he exuded was undeniable. His eyes sent coldness deep under my skin, where it spread like a stain.
"Domenico," Matthew said calmly, though his voice was louder than usual.
"Matthew?"
The glance the vampire turned on Matthew was full of hate.
"It's been years."
Matthew's casual tone suggested that the vampire's sudden appearance was an everyday occurrence. Domenico looked thoughtful.
"When was that? In Ferrara? We were both fighting the Pope, though for different reasons, as I remember. I was trying to save Venice. You were trying to save the Templars."
Matthew nodded slowly, his eyes fixed on the other vampire.
"I think you must be right. After that, my friend, you seemed to disappear. We shared so many adventures in our youth, on the seas, in the Holy Land. Venice was always full of amusements for a vampire such as you, Matthew."
Domenico shook his head in apparent sorrow. The vampire inside the chateau gate did look Venetian, or like some unholy cross between an angel and a devil.
"Why did you not come and visit me when you passed between France and one of your other haunts?"
"If I caused defense, Domenico, it was surely too long ago to be of any concern to us now."
"Perhaps, but one thing hasn't changed in all these years. Whenever there's a crisis, there's a de Clermont nearby."
He turned to me, and something avaricious bloomed on his face.
"This must be the witch I've heard so much about."
"Diana, go back to the house," Matthew said sharply.
The sense of danger was palpable, and I hesitated, not wanting to leave him alone.
"Go,"
he said again, his voice as keen-edged as a sword. Our vampire visitor spotted something over my shoulder and smiled. An icy breeze brushed past me, and a cold, hard arm linked through mine.
"Domenico," chimed Isabeau's musical voice. "What an unexpected visit."
He bowed formally.
"My lady, it is a pleasure to see you in such good health. How did you know I was here?"
"I smelled you," Isabeau said contemptuously. "You come here, to my house, uninvited? What would your mother say if she knew you behaved in such a fashion?"
"If my mother was still alive, we could ask her," Domenico said with barely concealed savagery. "Maman, take Diana back to the house."
"Of course, Mathieu. We will leave the two of you to talk."
Isabeau turned, tugging me along with her.
"I'll be gone more quickly if you let me deliver my message," Domenico warned. "If I have to come back, I won't be alone. Today's visit was a courtesy to you, Isabeau."
"She doesn't have the book," Matthew said sharply.
"I'm not here about the witch's damn book, Matthew. Let them keep it. I've come from the congregation."
Isabeau exhaled, soft and long, as if she'd been holding her breath for days. A question burbled to my lips, but she silenced it with a warning look.
"Well done, Domenico. I'm surprised you have time to call on old friends with all your new responsibilities."
Matthew's voice was scornful.
"Why is the congregation wasting time paying official visits on the de Clermont family when there are vampires leaving bloodless corpses all over Europe for humans to find?"
"It's not forbidden for vampires to feed on humans, though the carelessness is regrettable. As you know, death follows vampires wherever we go."
Domenico shrugged off the brutality, and I shivered at his casual disregard for frail, warm-blooded life.
"But the covenant clearly forbids any liaison between a vampire and a witch."
I turned and stared at Domenico.
"What did you say?"
"She can speak."
Domenico clasped his hands in mock delight.
"Why not let the witch take part in this conversation?"
Matthew reached around and drew me forward. Isabeau remained entwined through my other arm.
We stood in a short, tight line of vampire, witch, and vampire.
Diana Bishop.
Domenico bowed low.
It is an honor to meet a witch of such ancient, distinguished lineage. So few of the old families are still with us.
Every word he uttered, no matter how formally phrased, sounded like a threat. Who are you? I asked. And why are you concerned with whom I spend time? The Venetian looked at me with interest before his head fell back and he howled with laughter.
They said you were argumentative like your father, but I didn't believe them.
My fingers tingled slightly, and Isabeau's arm grew fractionally tighter.
Have I made your witch angry?
Domenico's eyes were fixed on Isabeau's arm.
Say what you came to say and get off our land.
Matthew's voice was entirely conversational.
My name is Domenico Michele. I have known Matthew since I was reborn, and Isabeau nearly as long. I know neither of them so well as I knew the lovely Louisa, of course. But we should not speak lightly of the dead.
The Venetian crossed himself piously.
You should try not to speak of my sister at all.
Matthew sounded calm, but Isabeau looked murderous, her lips white. You still haven't answered my question, I said, drawing Domenico's attention once more. The Venetian's eyes glittered with frank appraisal. Diana, Matthew said, unable to stop the rumble in his throat. It was as close as he'd ever been to growling at me. Mart came out of the kitchen, a look of alarm on her face.
She is more fiery than most of her kind, I see. Is that why you're risking everything to keep her with you? Does she amuse you? Or do you intend to feed on her until you get bored and then discard her, as you have with other warm bloods?
Matthew's hand strayed to Lazarus's coffin, evident only as a bump under his sweater. He hadn't touched it since we'd arrived at Set Tour. Domenico's keen eyes noticed the gesture too, and his answering smile was vindictive.
Feeling guilty.
Furious at the way Domenico was baiting Matthew, I opened my mouth to speak.
Diana, go back to the house immediately.
Matthew's tone suggested that we would have a serious, unpleasant talk later. He pushed me slightly in Isabeau's direction and put himself even more squarely between his mother, me, and the dark Venetian. By that time, Mart was nearby, her arms crossed over her sturdy body in a striking imitation of Matthew.
Not before the witch hears what I have to say. I've come to serve you with a warning, Diana Bishop. Relationships between witches and vampires are forbidden. You must leave this house and no longer associate with Matthew de Clermont or any of his family. If you don't, the congregation will take whatever steps are necessary to preserve the covenant.
I don't know your congregation, and I agreed to no such covenant, I said, still furious. Besides, covenants aren't enforceable. They're voluntary.
Are you a lawyer as well as a historian? You modern women with your fine educations are so fascinating, but women are no good at theology.
Domenico continued sorrowfully.
Which is why we never thought it worth educating you in the first place. Do you think we adhered to the ideas of that heretic Calvin when we made these promises to one another? When the covenant was sworn, it bound all vampires, demons, and witches. Past, present, and future. This is not a path you can follow or not as you please.
You've delivered your warning, Domenico, Matthew said in a voice like silk.
That's all I have to say to the witch, the Venetian replied. I have more to say to you.
Then Diana will return to the house. Get her out of here, Mama, he said tersely. This time his mother did what he asked immediately, and Mart followed. Don't, Isabeau hissed when I turned to look back at Matthew.
Where did that thing come from?
Mart asked once we were safely inside.
From El, presumably, said Isabeau.
She touched my face briefly with her fingertips, drawing them back hastily when they met the warmth of my angry cheeks.
You are brave, girl, but what you did was reckless. You are not a vampire. Do not put yourself at risk by arguing with Domenico or any of his allies. Stay away from them.
Isabeau gave me no time to respond, speeding me through the kitchens, the dining room, the salon, and into the great hall. Finally, she towed me toward the arch that led to the keep's most formidable tower. My calves seized up at the thought of the climb.
We must, she insisted. Mathieu will be looking for us there.
Fear and anger propelled me halfway up the stairs. The second half I conquered through sheer determination. Lifting my feet from the final tread, I found myself on a flat roof with a view for miles in every direction. A faint breeze blew, loosening my braided hair and coaxing the mist around me.
Isabeau moved swiftly to a pole that extended another dozen feet into the sky. She raised a forked black banner adorned with a silver Ouroboros. It unfurled in the gloomy light, the snake holding its shimmering tail in its mouth. I ran to the far side of the crenellated walls and Domenico looked up. Moments later, a similar banner rose over the top of a building in the village and a bell began to toll. Men and women slowly came out of houses, bars, shops, and offices, their faces turned toward Settur, where the ancient symbol of eternity and rebirth snapped in the wind. I looked at Isabeau, my question evident on my face.
"Our family's emblem, and a warning to the village to be on their guard," she explained. "We fly the banner only when others are with us. The villagers have grown too accustomed to living among vampires, and though they have nothing to fear from us, we have kept it for times such as this. The world is full of vampires who cannot be trusted, Diana. Domenico Michele is one of them."
"You didn't need to tell me that. Who the hell is he?"
"One of Mathieu's oldest friends," Isabeau murmured, eyes on her son. "Which makes him a very dangerous enemy."
My attention turned to Matthew, who continued to exchange words with Domenico across a precisely drawn zone of engagement. There was a blur of black and gray movement, and the Venetian hurtled backward toward the chestnut tree he'd been leaning against when we first spotted him. A loud crack carried across the grounds.
"Well done," Isabeau muttered.
"Where's Mart?"
I looked over my shoulder toward the stairs.
"In the hall, just in case."
Isabeau's keen eyes remained fixed on her son.
"Would Domenico really come in here and rip my throat open?"
Isabeau turned her black, glittering gaze on me.
"That would be all too easy, my dear. He would play with you first. He always plays with his prey. And Domenico loves an audience."
I swallowed hard. "I'm capable of taking care of myself."
"You are, if you have as much power as Mathieu believes. Witches are very good at protecting themselves, I've found, with a little effort and a drop of courage," Isabeau said.
"What is this congregation that Domenico mentioned?" I asked.
"A council of nine, three from each order of demons, witches, and vampires. It was established during the Crusades to keep us from being exposed to the humans. We were careless and became too involved in their politics and other forms of insanity."
Isabeau's voice was bitter.
"Ambition, pride, and grasping creatures like Michele who were never content with their lot in life and always wanted more. They drove us to the Covenant."
"And you agreed to certain conditions?" It was ludicrous to think that promises made by creatures in the Middle Ages could affect Matthew and me. Isabeau nodded, the breeze catching a few strands of her heavy, honeyed hair and moving them around her face.
"When we mixed with one another, we were too conspicuous. When we became involved in human affairs, they grew suspicious of our cleverness. They are not quick, the poor creatures, but they are not entirely stupid either."
"By mixing, you don't mean dinners and dancing?"
"No dinners, no dancing, and no kissing and singing songs to each other," Isabeau said pointedly. "And what comes after the dancing and the kissing was forbidden as well. We were full of arrogance before we agreed to the Covenant. There were more of us, and we'd become accustomed to taking whatever we wanted, no matter the cost."
"What else does this promise cover?"
"No politics or religion. Too many princes and popes were otherworldly creatures. It became more difficult to pass from one life to the next once humans started writing their chronicles."
Isabeau shuddered.
"Vampires found it difficult to feign a good death and move on to a new life with humans nosing around."
I glanced quickly at Matthew and Domenico, but they were still talking outside the chateau's walls. "So," I repeated, ticking items off my fingers, "no mixing between different types of creatures? No careers in human politics or religion, anything else?" Apparently, my aunt's xenophobia and fierce opposition to my studying the law derived from her imperfect understanding of this long-ago agreement.
"Yes, If any creature breaks the covenant, it's the responsibility of the congregation to see that the misconduct is stopped and the oath is upheld. And if two creatures break the covenant? The silence stretched taut between us.
To my knowledge, it has never happened, she said grimly. It is a very good thing, therefore, that the two of you have not done so.
Last night I'd made a simple request that Matthew join me in my bed, but he'd known it wasn't a simple request. It wasn't me he was unsure of, or his feelings. Matthew wanted to know how far he could go before the congregation would intervene. The answer had come quickly. They weren't going to let us get very far at all. My relief was quickly replaced by anger. Had no one complained as our relationship developed, he might never have told me about the congregation or the covenant, and his silence would have had implications for my relationship with my own family and with his. I might have gone to my grave believing that my aunt and Isabeau were bigots. Instead, they were living up to a promise made long ago, which was less understandable, but somehow more excusable. Your son needs to stop keeping things from me. My temper rose, the tingling mounting in my fingertips. And you should worry less about the congregation and more about what I'm going to do when I see him again. She snorted. You won't get the chance to do much before he takes you to task for questioning his authority in front of Domenico. I'm not under Matthew's authority.
You, my dear, have a great deal to learn about vampires, she said with a note of satisfaction.
And you have a great deal to learn about me. So does the congregation. Isabeau took me by the shoulders, her fingers digging into the flesh of my arms.
This is not a game, Diana. Matthew would willingly turn his back on creatures he has known for centuries to protect your right to be whatever you imagine you want to be in your fleeting life. I'm begging you not to let him do it. They will kill him if he persists.
He's his own man, Isabeau, I said coldly. I don't tell Matthew what to do.
No, but you have the power to send him away. Tell him you refuse to break the covenant for him, for his sake, or that you feel nothing more for him than curiosity, witches are famous for it. She flung me away. If you love him, you'll know what to say.
It is over,
Mart called from the top of the stairs. We both rushed to the edge of the tower. A black horse and rider streaked out of the stables and cleared the paddock fence before thundering into the forest. Chapter 22. We'd been waiting in the salon, the three of us, since he'd ridden off on Balthazar in the late morning. Now the shadows were lengthening toward twilight. A human would be half dead from the prolonged effort needed to control that enormous horse in the open countryside. However, the events of the morning had reminded me that Matthew wasn't human, but a vampire, with many secrets, a complicated past, and frightening enemies. Overhead, a door closed.
He's back. He will go to his father's room, as he always does when he is troubled, Isabeau explained.
Matthew's beautiful young mother sat and stared at the fire while I wrung my hands in my lap, refusing everything Mart put in front of me. I hadn't eaten since breakfast, but my hollowness had nothing to do with hunger. I felt shattered, surrounded by the broken pieces of my formerly ordered life. My degree from Oxford, my position at Yale, and my carefully researched and written books had long provided meaning and structure to my life. But none of them were of comfort to me in this strange new world of menacing vampires and threatening witches. My exposure to it had left me raw, with the new fragility linked to a vampire and the invisible, undeniable movement of a witch's blood in my veins. At last Matthew entered the salon, clean and dressed in fresh clothes. His eyes sought me out immediately, their cold touch fluttering over me as he checked that I was unharmed. His mouth softened in relief. It was the last hint of comforting familiarity that I detected in him. The vampire who entered the salon was not the Matthew that I knew. He was not the elegant, charming creature who had slipped into my life with a mocking smile and invitations to breakfast.
Nor was he the scientist, absorbed in his work and preoccupied with the question of why he was here. And there was no sign of the Matthew who had swung me into his arms and kissed me with such passionate intensity only the night before. This Matthew was cold and impassive. The few soft edges he'd once possessed, around his mouth, in the delicacy of his hands, the stillness of his eyes, had been replaced by hard lines and angles. He seemed older than I remembered, a combination of weariness and careful remove reflecting every moment of his nearly 1,500 years of age. A log broke in the fireplace. The sparks caught my eye, burning blood orange as they fell in the grate. Nothing but the color red appeared at first. Then the red took on a texture, strands of red burnished here and there with gold and silver. The texture became a thing, hair, Sarah's hair. My fingers caught the strap of a backpack from my shoulder, and I dropped my lunchbox on the floor of the family room with the same officious clatter as my father when he dropped his briefcase by the door.
"I'm home!"
My child's voice was high and bright.
"Are there cookies?"
Sarah's head turned, red and orange, catching the sparks in the late afternoon light. But her face was pure white. The white overwhelmed the other colors, became silver, and assumed a texture like the scales of a fish. Chainmail clung to a familiar, muscular body. Matthew.
"I'm through."
His white hands tore at a black tunic with a silver cross on the front, rending it at the shoulders. He flung it at someone's feet, turned, and strode away. With a single blink of my eyes, the vision was gone, replaced by the warm tones of the salon at set tour, but the startling knowledge of what had happened lingered. As with the witch wind, there had been no warning when this hidden talent of mine was released. Had my mother's visions come on so suddenly and had such clarity? I glanced around the room, but the only creature who seemed to have noticed something was odd was Mart, who looked at me with concern. Matthew went to Isabeau and kissed her lightly on both of her flawless white cheeks.
"I'm so sorry, Maman," he murmured.
"Eh, he was always a pig. It's not your fault."
Isabeau gave her son's hand a gentle squeeze.
"I'm glad you are home."
"He's gone. There's nothing to worry about tonight," Matthew said, his mouth tight.
He drew his fingers through his hair.
"Drink."
Mart belonged to the sustenance school of crisis management. She handed a glass of wine to Matthew and plunked yet another cup of tea next to me. It sat on the table untouched, sending tendrils of steam into the room.
"Thank you, Mart."
Matthew drank deeply. As he did, his eyes returned to mine, but he deliberately looked away as he swallowed.
"My phone," he said, turning toward his study.
He descended the stairs a few moments later.
"For you."
He gave me the phone in such a way that our hands didn't need to touch.
I knew who was on the line.
"Hello, Sarah."
"I've been calling for more than 8 hours. What on earth is wrong?"
Sarah knew something bad was happening. She wouldn't have called a vampire otherwise. Her tense voice conjured up the image of her white face from my vision. She'd been frightened in it, not just sad.
"There's nothing wrong," I said, not wanting her to be scared anymore. "I'm with Matthew." "Being with Matthew is what got you into this trouble in the first place."
"Sarah,
I can't talk now."
The last thing I needed was to argue with my aunt. She drew in her breath.
"Diana, there are a few things you need to know before you decide to throw in your lot with a vampire."
"Really?" I asked, my temper flaring.
"Do you think now is the time to tell me about the Covenant? You don't by any chance know the witches who are among the current members of the congregation, do you? I have a few things I'd like to say to them."
My fingers were burning, and the skin under my nails had become a vivid sky blue.
"You turned your back on your power, Diana, and refused to talk about magic. The Covenant wasn't relevant to your life, nor was the congregation."
Sarah sounded defensive. My bitter laugh helped the blue tinge fade from my fingers.
"Justify it any way you want, Sarah. After Mom and Dad were killed, you and Em should have told me, and not just hinted at something in mysterious half-truths. But it's too late now. I need to talk to Matthew. I'll call you tomorrow. After severing the connection and flinging the phone onto the ottoman at my feet, I closed my eyes and waited for the tingling in my fingers to subside. All three vampires were staring at me. I could feel it. So, I said into the silence, are we to expect more visitors from this congregation? Matthew's mouth tightened. No. It was a one-word answer, but at least it was the word I wanted to hear. Over the past few days, I'd had a respite from Matthew's mood changes, and had almost forgotten how alarming they could be. His next words wiped away my hope that this latest outburst would soon pass. There will be no visits from the congregation because we aren't going to break the covenant. We'll stay here for a few more days, then return to Oxford. Is that all right with you, Mama?
Of course,
Isabeau replied promptly. She sighed with relief. We should keep the standard flying, Matthew continued, his voice businesslike. The village should know to be on its guard. Isabeau nodded, and her son took a sip of his wine. I stared, first at one, and then the other. Neither responded to my silent demand for more information. It's only been a few days since you took me out of Oxford, I said after no one rose to my wordless challenge. Matthew's eyes lifted to mine in forbidding response. Now you're going back, he said evenly. Meanwhile, there will be no walks outside the grounds, no riding on your own. His present coldness was more frightening than anything Domenico had said. And? I pressed him. No more dancing, Matthew said, his abruptness suggesting that a host of other activities were included in this category. We're going to abide by the congregation's rules. If we stop aggravating them, they'll turn their attention to more important matters. I see you want me to play dead, and you'll give up your work and Ashmole 782? I don't believe that. I stood and moved toward the door. Matthew's hand was rough on my arm. It violated all the laws of physics that he could have reached my side so quickly. Sit down, Diana. His voice was as rough as his touch, but it was oddly gratifying that he was showing any emotion at all. Why are you giving in? I whispered. To avoid exposing us all to the humans, and to keep you alive. He pulled me back to the sofa and pushed me onto the cushions. This family is not a democracy, especially not at a time like this. When I tell you to do something, you do it, without hesitation or question. Understood? Matthew's tone indicated that the discussion was over. Or what? I was deliberately provoking him, but his aloofness frightened me. He put down his wine, and the crystal captured the light from the candles. I felt myself falling, this time into a pool of water. The pool became a drop, the drop a tear glistening on a white cheek. Sarah's cheeks were covered in tears, her eyes red and swollen. Em was in the kitchen. When she joined us, it was evident that she'd been crying too. She looked devastated. What? I said, fear gripping my stomach. What's happened? Sarah wiped at her eyes, her fingers stained with the herbs and spices she used in her spellcasting. Her fingers grew longer, the stains dissolving. What? Matthew said, his eyes wild, white fingers brushing a tiny, blood-stained tear from an equally white cheek. What's happened?
Witches.
They have your father, Isabeau said, her voice breaking.
As the vision faded, I searched for Matthew, hoping his eyes would exert their usual pull and relieve my lingering disorientation. As soon as our glances met, he came and hovered over me, but there was none of the usual comfort associated with his presence.
I will kill you myself before I let anyone hurt you. The words caught in his throat, and I don't want to kill you, so please do what I tell you.
So that's it? I asked when I could manage it. We're going to abide by an ancient, narrow-minded agreement made almost 1,000 years ago? Case closed?
You mustn't be under the congregation scrutiny.
You have no control over your magic and no understanding of your relationship to Ashmole 782. At Set Tool, you may be protected from Peter Knox, Diana, but I've told you before that you aren't safe around vampires. No warm blood is, ever.
You won't hurt me.
In spite of what had happened over the past several days, on this point I was absolutely certain.
You persist in this romantic vision of what it is to be a vampire, but despite my best efforts to curb it, I have a taste for blood.
I made a dismissive gesture. You've killed humans. I know this, Matthew. You're a vampire and you've lived for hundreds of years. Do you think I imagine you survived on nothing but animals?
Isabeau was watching her son closely.
Saying you know I've killed humans and understanding what that means are two different things, Diana. You have no idea what I'm capable of.
He touched his talisman from Bethany and moved away from me with swift, impatient steps.
I know who you are.
Here was another point of absolute certainty. I wondered what made me so instinctively sure of Matthew, as the evidence about the brutality of vampires, even witches, mounted.
You don't know yourself. And 3 weeks ago you'd never heard of me.
Matthew's gaze was restless, and his hands, like mine, were shaking.
This worried me less than the fact that Isabeau had pitched farther forward in her seat. He picked up a poker and gave the fire a vicious thrust before throwing it aside. The metal rang against the stone, gouging the hard surface as if it were butter.
We will figure this out. Give us some time.
I tried to make my voice low and soothing.
There's nothing to figure out.
Matthew was pacing now. You have too much undisciplined power. It's like a drug. A highly addictive, dangerous drug that other creatures are desperate to share. You'll never be safe so long as a witch or vampire is near you.
My mouth opened to respond, but the place where he'd been standing was empty. Matthew's icy fingers were on my chin, lifting me to my feet.
I'm a predator, Diana.
He said it with the seductiveness of a lover. The dark aroma of cloves made me dizzy. I have to hunt and kill to survive. He turned my face away from him with a savage twist, exposing my neck. His restless eyes raked over my throat.
Mathieu, put Diana down.
Isabeau sounded unconcerned, and my own faith in him remained unshaken. He wanted to frighten me off for some reason, but I was in no real danger, not as I'd been with Domenico.
She thinks she knows me, Mama, he purred, but Diana doesn't know what it's like when the craving for a warm blood tightens your stomach so much that you're mad with need. She doesn't know how much we want to feel the blood of another heart pulsing through our veins, or how difficult it is for me to stand here, so close, and not taste her.
Isabeau rose but remained where she was.
Now is not the time to teach her, Matthew.
You see, it's not just that I could kill you outright, he continued, ignoring his mother. His black eyes were mesmerizing. I could feed on you slowly, taking your blood and letting it replenish, only to begin again the next day. His grip moved from my chin to circle my neck, and his thumb stroked the pulse at my throat as if he were gauging just where to sink his teeth into my flesh.
Stop it, I said sharply. His scare tactics had gone on long enough.
Matthew dropped me abruptly on the soft carpet. By the time I felt the impact, the vampire was across the room, his back to me and his head bowed. I stared at the pattern on the rug beneath my hands and knees. A swirl of colors, too many to distinguish, moved before my eyes. They were leaves dancing against the sky, green, brown, blue, gold.
It's your mom and dad, Sarah was explaining, her voice tight. They've been killed.
They're gone, honey.
I dragged my eyes from the carpet to the vampire standing with his back to me.
No.
I shook my head.
What is it, Diana?
Matthew turned, concern momentarily pushing the predator away. The swirl of colors captured my attention again. Green, brown, blue, gold. They were leaves, caught in an eddy on a pool of water, falling onto the ground around my hands. A bow,
curved and polished, rested next to a scattering of arrows and a half-empty quiver. I reached for the bow and felt the taut string cut into my flesh.
Mathieu,
Isabeau warned, sniffing the air delicately.
I know. I can smell it too, he said grimly.
He's yours, a strange voice whispered. You mustn't let him go.
I know, I murmured impatiently.
What do you know, Diana?
Matthew took a step toward me.
Mart shot to my side. Leave her, she hissed. The child is not in this world.
I was nowhere, caught between the terrible ache of losing my parents and the certain knowledge that soon Matthew too would be gone.
Be careful, the strange voice warned.
It's too late for that. I raised my hand from the floor and smashed it into the bow, snapping it in two. Much too late.
What's too late? Matthew asked.
I've fallen in love with you.
You can't have, he said numbly.
The room was utterly silent, except for the crackling of the fire. It's too soon.
Why do vampires have such a strange attitude toward time? I mused aloud, still caught in a bewildering mix of past and present. The word love had sent feelings of possessiveness through me, however, drawing me to the here and now.
Witches don't have centuries to fall in love. We do it quickly. Sarah says my mother fell in love with my father the moment she saw him. I've loved you since I decided not to hit you with an oar on the city of Oxford's dock.
The blood in my veins began to hum.
Mart looked startled, suggesting she could hear it too.
You don't understand.
It sounded as if Matthew, like the bow, might snap in two.
I do. The congregation will try to stop me, but they won't tell me who to love.
When my parents were taken from me, I was a child with no options and did what people told me. I was an adult now, and I was going to fight for Matthew.
Domenico's overtures are nothing compared with what you can expect from Peter Knox. What happened today was an attempt at rapprochement, a diplomatic mission. You aren't ready to face the congregation, Diana, no matter what you think. And if you did stand up to them, what then? Bringing these old animosities to the surface could spin out of control, expose us to humans. Your family might suffer.
Matthew's words were brutal, meant to make me stop and reconsider. But nothing he said outweighed what I felt for him.
I love you, and I'm not going to stop.
Of this, too, I was certain.
You are not in love with me.
I decide who I love, and how, and when. Stop telling me what to do, Matthew.
My ideas about vampires may be romantic, but your attitudes toward women need a major overhaul.
Before he could respond, his phone began to hop across the ottoman. He swore an oath in Occitan that must have been truly awe-inspiring, because even Mart looked shocked. He reached down and snagged the phone before it could skitter onto the floor.
What is it? He said, his eyes fixed on me.
There were faint murmurs on the other end of the line. Mart and Isabeau exchanged worried glances.
When?
Matthew's voice sounded like a gunshot.
Did they take anything?
My forehead creased at the anger in his voice.
Thank God. Was there damage?
Something had happened in Oxford while we were gone, and it sounded like a robbery. I hoped it wasn't the old lodge. The voice on the other end of the phone continued. Matthew passed a hand over his eyes.
What else? He asked, his voice rising.
There was another long silence. He turned away and walked to the fireplace, his right hand splayed flat against the mantel.
So much for diplomacy.
Matthew swore under his breath.
I'll be there in a few hours. Can you pick me up?
We were going back to Oxford. I stood.
Fine. I'll call before I land.
And Marcus?
Find out who else besides Peter Knox and Domenico Michele are members of the congregation.
Peter Knox? The pieces of the puzzle began to click into place. No wonder Matthew had come back to Oxford so quickly when I'd told him who the Brown Wizard was. It explained why he was so eager to push me away now, too. We were breaking the covenant, and it was Knox's job to enforce it. Matthew stood silently for a few moments after the line went dead, one hand clenched as if he were resisting the urge to beat the stone mantle into submission.
That was Marcus. Someone tried to break into the lab. I need to go back to Oxford.
He turned, his eyes dead.
Is everything all right?
Isabeau shot a worried look in my direction.
They didn't make it through the security controls. Still, I need to talk to the university officials and make sure whoever it was doesn't succeed the next time.
Nothing that Matthew was saying made sense. If the burglars had failed, why wasn't he relieved? And why was he shaking his head at his mother?
Who were they? I asked warily.
Marcus isn't sure.
That was odd, given a vampire's preternaturally sharp sense of smell. Was it humans?
No.
We were back to the monosyllabic answers. I'll get my things. I turned toward the stairs.
You aren't coming. You're staying here.
Matthew's words brought me to a standstill. I'd rather be in Oxford, I protested, with you.
Oxford's not safe at the moment. I'll be back when it is.
You just told me we should return there. Make up your mind, Matthew. Where is the danger? The manuscript and the witches? Peter Knox and the congregation? Or Domenico Michele and the vampires?
Were you listening? I am the danger.
Matthew's voice was sharp.
Oh, I heard you. But you're keeping something from me.
It's a historian's job to uncover secrets, I promised him softly, and I'm very good at it. He opened his mouth to speak, but I stopped him. No more excuses or false explanations. Go to Oxford. I'll stay here.
Do you need anything from upstairs? Isabeau asked. You should take a coat. Humans will notice if you're wearing only a sweater.
Just my computer. My passport's in the bag.
I'll get them. Wanting a respite from all the de Clermonts for a moment, I pelted up the stairs. In Matthew's study, I looked around the room that held so much of him. The armor's silvery surfaces winked in the firelight, holding my attention while a jumble of faces flashed through my mind, the visions as swift as comets through the sky. There was a pale woman with enormous blue eyes and a sweet smile, another woman whose firm chin and square shoulders exuded determination, a man with a hawkish nose in terrible pain. There were other faces, too, but the only one I recognized was Louisa de Clermont, holding dripping, bloody fingers in front of her face. Resisting the vision's pull helped the faces fade, but it left my body shaking and my mind bewildered. The DNA report had indicated that visions were likely to come, but there'd been no more warning of their arrival than there had been last night when I floated in Matthew's arms. It was as if someone had pulled the stopper on a bottle and my magic, released at last, was rushing to get out. Once I was able to jerk the cord from the socket, I slid it into Matthew's bag along with the computer. His passport was in the front pocket, as he'd said it would be. When I returned to the salon, Matthew was alone, his keys in his hands and a suede barn jacket draped across his shoulders. Mart muttered and paced in the great hall. I handed him his computer and stood far away to better resist the urge to touch him once more. Matthew pocketed his keys and took the bag.
I know this is hard.
His voice was hushed and strange.
But you need to let me take care of it. And I need to know that you're safe while I'm doing that.
I'm safe with you, wherever we are.
He shook his head.
My name should have been enough to protect you. It wasn't.
Leaving me isn't the answer. I don't understand all of what's happened today, but Domenico's hatred goes beyond me.
He wants to destroy your family and everything else you care about.
Domenico might decide this isn't the right time to pursue his vendetta, but Peter Knox? He wants Ashmole 782, and he thinks I can get it for him. He won't be put off so easily.
I shivered.
He'll make a deal if I offer him one.
A deal? What do you have to trade?
The vampire fell silent.
Matthew?
I insisted. The manuscript, he said flatly. I'll leave it and you alone if he promises the same. Ashmole 782 has been undisturbed for a century and a half. We'll let it remain that way.
You can't make a deal with Knox. He can't be trusted.
I was horrified.
Besides, you have all the time you need to wait for the manuscript. Knox doesn't. Your deal won't appeal to him.
Just leave Knox to me, he said gruffly.
My eyes snapped with anger. Leave Domenico to you, leave Knox to you. What do you imagine I'm going to do? You said I'm not a damsel in distress, so stop treating me like one.
I suppose I deserved that, he said slowly, his eyes black. But you have a lot to learn about vampires.
So your mother tells me. But you may have a few things to learn about witches, too. I pushed the hair out of my eyes and crossed my arms over my chest. Go to Oxford. Sort out what happened there.
Whatever happened that you won't share with me.
But for God's sake, Matthew, don't negotiate with Peter Knox. Decide how you feel about me, not because of what the Covenant forbids or the congregation wants, or even what Peter Knox and Domenico Michele make you afraid of.
My beloved vampire, with a face that would make an angel envious, looked at me with sorrow.
You know how I feel about you. I shook my head.
No, I don't. When you're ready, you'll tell me.
Matthew struggled with something and left it unsaid. Wordlessly, he walked to the door in the hall. When he reached it, he gave me a long look of snowflakes and frost before walking through. Mart met him in the hall. He kissed her softly on both cheeks and said something in rapid Occitan.
Compreni, compreni, she said, nodding vehemently and looking past him at me.
Messes. Am tout meu corps, he said quietly.
Al ribere, mefi.
Ta fortissi.
Matthew turned to me.
And you'll promise me the same thing, that you'll be careful. Listen to Isabeau.
He left, without a glance or a final reassuring touch. I bit my lip and tried to swallow the tears, but they spilled out. After three slow steps toward the watchtower stairs, my feet began to run, tears streaming down my face. With a look of understanding, Mart let me go. When I came out into the cold, damp air, the De Clermont Standard was snapping gently to and fro, and the clouds continued to obscure the moon. Darkness pressed on me from every direction, and the one creature who kept it at bay was leaving, taking the light with him. Peering down over the tower's ramparts, I saw Matthew standing by the Range Rover, talking furiously to Isabeau. She looked shocked and grabbed the sleeve of his jacket as if to stop him from getting in the car. His hand was a white blur as he pulled his arm free. His fist pounded once into the car's roof. I jumped. Matthew had never used his strength on anything bigger than a walnut or an oyster shell when he was around me, and the dent he'd left in the metal was alarmingly deep. He hung his head. Isabeau touched him lightly on the cheek, his sad features gleaming in the dim light. He climbed into the car and said a few more words. His mother nodded and looked briefly at the watchtower. I stepped back, hoping neither of them had seen me. The car turned over, and its heavy tires crunched across the gravel as Matthew pulled away. The Range Rover's lights disappeared below the hill. With Matthew gone, I slid down the stone wall of the keep and gave in to the tears. It was then that I discovered what witch water was all about. Chapter 23. Before I met Matthew, there didn't seem to be room in my life for a single additional element, especially not something as significant as a 1,500-year-old vampire. But he'd slipped into unexplored, empty places when I wasn't looking. Now that he'd left, I was terribly aware of his absence. As I sat on the roof of the watchtower, my tears softened my determination to fight for him. Soon there was water everywhere. I was sitting in a puddle of it, and the level just kept rising. It wasn't raining, despite the cloudy skies. The water was coming out of me.
My tears fell normally, but swelled,
as they dropped into globules the size of snowballs that hit the stone roof of the watchtower with a splash. My hair snaked over my shoulders in sheets of water that poured over the curves of my body. I opened my mouth to take a breath because the water streaming down my face was blocking my nose, and water gushed out in a torrent that tasted of the sea. Through a film of moisture, Mart and Isabeau watched me. Mart's face was grim, Isabeau's lips were moving, but the roar of 1,000 seashells made it impossible to hear her. I stood, hoping the water would stop. It didn't. I tried to tell the two women to let the water carry me away along with my grief and the memory of Matthew, but all that produced was another gush of ocean. I reached out, thinking that would help the water drain from me. Even more water cascaded from my fingertips. The gesture reminded me of my mother's arm reaching toward my father, and the waves increased. As the water poured forth, my control slipped further. Domenico's sudden appearance had frightened me more than I'd been willing to admit. Matthew was gone, and I had vowed to fight for him against enemies I couldn't identify and didn't understand. It was now clear that Matthew's past was not composed simply of homely elements of firelight, wine, and books, nor had it unfolded solely within the limits of a loyal family. Domenico had alluded to something darker that was full of enmity, danger, and death. Exhaustion overtook me, and the water pulled me under. A strange sense of exhilaration accompanied the fatigue. I was poised between mortality and something elemental that held within it the promise of a vast, incomprehensible power. If I surrendered to the undertow, there would be no more Diana Bishop. Instead, I would become water, nowhere, everywhere, free of my body and the pain. "I'm sorry, Matthew." My words were nothing more than a burble as the water began its inexorable work. Isabeau stepped toward me, and a sharp crack sounded in my brain. My warning to her was lost in a roar like a tidal wave coming ashore. The winds rose around my feet, whipping the water into a hurricane. I raised my arms to the sky, water and wind shaping themselves into a funnel that encircled my body. Mart grabbed Isabeau's arm, her mouth moving rapidly. Matthew's mother tried to pull away, her own mouth shaping the word no, but Mart held on, staring at her fixedly. After a few moments, Isabeau's shoulders slumped. She turned toward me and started to sing. Haunting and yearning, her voice penetrated the water and called me back to the world. The winds began to die down. The De Clermont Standard, which had been whipping around, resumed its gentle swaying. The cascade of water from my fingertips slowed to a river, then to a trickle, and stopped entirely. The waves flowing from my hair subsided into swells, and then they too disappeared. At last, nothing came out of my mouth but a gasp of surprise. The balls of water falling from my eyes were the last vestige of the witch water to disappear, just as they had been the first sign of its power moving through me. The remains of my deluge sluiced toward small holes at the base of the crenellated walls. Far, far below, water splashed onto the courtyard's thick bed of gravel. When the last of the water left me, I felt scooped out like a pumpkin, and freezing cold, too. My knees buckled, banging painfully on the stone.
"Thank God," Isabeau murmured. "We almost lost her."
I was shaking violently from exhaustion and cold. Both women flew at me and lifted me to my feet. They each gripped an elbow and supported me down the curving flight of stairs with a speed that made me shiver. Once in the hall, Mart headed toward Matthew's rooms, and Isabeau pulled in the opposite direction.
"Mina closer," Matthew's mother said sharply. "She will feel safer closer to him," Mart said.
With a sound of exasperation, Isabeau conceded. At the bottom of Matthew's staircase, Isabeau blurted out a string of colorful phrases that sounded totally incongruous coming from her delicate mouth.
"I'll carry her," she said,
when she was finished cursing her son, the forces of nature, the powers of the universe, and many other unspecified individuals of questionable parentage who'd taken part in building the tower. Isabeau lifted my much larger body easily.
Why he had to make these stairs so twisting and in two separate flights is beyond my understanding.
Mart tucked my wet hair into the crook of Isabeau's elbow and shrugged.
To make it harder, of course. He has always made things harder. For him, for everyone else, too.
No one had thought to come up in the late afternoon to light the candles, but the fire still smoldered and the room retained some of its warmth. Mart disappeared into the bathroom, and the sound of running water made me examine my fingers with alarm. Isabeau threw two enormous logs onto the grate as if they were kindling, snapping a long splinter off of one before it caught. She stirred the coals into flames with it, and then used it to light a dozen candles in the space of a few seconds. In their warm glow, she surveyed me anxiously from head to foot.
"You will never forgive me if you become ill," she said, picking up my hands and examining my nails.
They were bluish again, but not from electricity. Now they were blue with cold and wrinkled from witch water. She rubbed them vigorously between her palms. Still shaking so much that my teeth were chattering, I withdrew my hands to hug myself in an attempt to conserve what little warmth was left in my body. Isabeau picked me up again without ceremony and swept me into the bathroom.
"She needs to be in there now," Isabeau said brusquely.
The room was full of steam, and Mart turned from the bath to help strip off my clothes. Soon I was naked, and the two of them were lifting me into the hot water, one cold vampiric hand in each armpit. The shock of the water's heat on my frigid skin was extreme. Crying out, I struggled to pull myself from Matthew's deep bathtub.
"Shh," Isabeau said, holding my hair away from my face while Mart pushed me back into the water.
"It will warm you. We must get you warm."
Mart stood sentinel at one end of the tub, and Isabeau remained at the other, whispering soothing sounds and humming softly under her breath. It was a long time before the shaking stopped. At one point, Mart murmured something in Occitan that included the name Marcus. Isabeau and I said no at the same moment.
"I'll be fine. Don't tell Marcus what happened. Matthew mustn't know about the magic, not now," I said through chattering teeth.
"We just need some time to warm you."
Isabeau sounded calm, but she looked concerned.
Slowly, the heat began to reverse the changes the witch water had worked on my body.
Mart kept adding fresh hot water to the tub as my body cooled it down. Isabeau grabbed a beat-up tin pitcher from under the window and dipped it into the bath, pouring hot water over my head and shoulders. Once my head was warm, she wrapped it in a towel and pushed me slightly lower in the water.
"Soak," she commanded.
Mart bustled between the bathroom and the bedroom, carrying clothes and towels. She tutted over my lack of pajamas and the old yoga clothes I'd brought to sleep in. None of them met her requirements for warmth.
Isabeau felt my cheeks and the top of my head with the back of her hand. She nodded.
They let me get myself out of the tub. The water falling off my body reminded me of the watchtower roof, and I dug my toes into the floor to resist the element's insidious pull. Mart and Isabeau bundled me into towels fresh from the fireside that smelled faintly of wood smoke. In the bedroom, they somehow managed to dry me without ever exposing an inch of my flesh to the air, rolling me this way and that inside the towels until I could feel heat radiating from my body. Rough strokes of another towel scratched against my hair before Mart's fingers raked through the strands and twisted them into a tight braid against my scalp. Isabeau tossed the damp towels onto a chair near the fire as I shed them to dress, seemingly unconcerned by their contact with antique wood and fine upholstery. Now fully clothed, I sat down and stared mindlessly at the fire. Mart disappeared without a word into the lower regions of the chateau and returned with a tray of tiny sandwiches and a steaming pot of her herbal tea.
"You will eat. Now."
It was not a request, but a command. I brought one of the sandwiches to my mouth and nibbled around the edges. Mart's eyes narrowed at this sudden change in my eating habits.
"Eat."
The food tasted like sawdust, but my stomach rumbled nonetheless. After I'd swallowed two of the tiny sandwiches, Mart thrust a mug into my hands. She didn't need to tell me to drink. The hot liquid slid down my throat,
carrying away the water's salty vestiges.
Was that witch water?
I shivered at the memory of all that water coming out of me.
Isabeau, who'd been standing by the window looking out into the darkness, walked toward the opposite sofa.
Yes, she said. It has been a long time, though, since we have seen it come forth like that.
Thank God that wasn't the usual way, I said faintly, swallowing another sip of tea.
Most witches today are not powerful enough to draw on the witch water as you did. They can make waves on ponds and cause rain when there are clouds. They do not become the water.
Isabeau sat across from me, studying me with evident curiosity. I had become the water. Knowing that this was no longer common made me feel vulnerable, and even more alone. A phone rang.
Isabeau reached into her pocket and pulled out a small red phone that seemed uncharacteristically bright and high-tech against her pale skin and classic, buff-colored clothes.
Oui? Ah, good. I'm glad that you are there safe.
She spoke English out of courtesy to me and nodded in my direction.
Yes, she is fine. She is eating.
She stood and handed me the phone.
Mathieu would like to speak with you.
Diana?
Mathieu was barely audible.
Yes?
I didn't trust myself to say much, for fear that more than words would tumble out. He made a soft sound of relief.
I just wanted to make sure you were all right.
Your mother and Martyr taking good care of me.
And I didn't flood the castle, I thought.
You're tired. The distance between us was making him anxious, and he was tuned into every nuance of our exchange.
I am. It's been a long day.
Sleep, then, he said, his tone unexpectedly gentle. My eyes closed against the sudden sting of tears. There would be little sleep for me tonight. I was too worried about what he might do in some half-baked, heroic attempt to protect me.
Have you been to the lab?
I'm headed there now. Marcus wants me to go over everything carefully and make sure we've taken all the necessary precautions. Miriam's checked the security at the house as well. He told the half-truth with smooth conviction, but I knew it for what it was. The silence stretched out until it became uncomfortable.
Don't do it, Mathieu. Please don't try to negotiate with Knox.
I'll make sure you're safe before you return to Oxford.
Then there's nothing more to say. You've decided, so have I.
I returned the phone to Isabeau.
She frowned, her cold fingers pulling it from my grip. Isabeau said goodbye to her son, his reply audible only as a staccato burst of unintelligible sound.
Thank you for not telling him about the witch water, I said quietly after she'd disconnected the line.
That is your tale to tell. Not mine.
Isabeau drifted toward the fireplace. It's no good trying to tell a story you don't understand. Why is the power coming out now? First it was the wind, then the visions, and now the water, too. I shuddered.
What kind of visions?
Isabeau asked, her curiosity evident.
Didn't Mathieu tell you? My DNA has all this magic, I said, stumbling over the word, in it. The tests warned there might be visions, and they've begun.
Mathieu would never tell me what your blood revealed, certainly not without your permission, and probably not with your permission either.
I've seen them here in the chateau. I hesitated. How did you learn to control them?
Mathieu told you that I had visions before I became a vampire?
Isabeau shook her head.
He should not have.
Were you a witch?
That might explain why she disliked me so much.
A witch?
No.
Mathieu wonders if I was a demon, but I'm sure I was an ordinary human. They have their visionaries, too. It's not only creatures who are blessed and cursed in this way.
Did you ever manage to control your second sight and anticipate it?
It gets easier. There are warning signs. They can be subtle, but you will learn.
Mart helped me as well.
It was the only piece of information I had about Mart's past. Not for the first time, I wondered how old these two women were, and what workings of fate had brought them together.
Mart stood with her arms crossed.
"Och," she said, giving Isabeau a tender, protective look. "It is easier if you let the visions move through you without fighting."
"I'm too shocked to fight," I said, thinking back to the salon and the library.
"Shock is your body's way of resisting," Isabeau said. "You must try to relax."
"It's difficult to let go when you see knights in armor and the faces of women you'd never met mixed up with scenes from your own past." My jaw cracked with a yawn.
"You are too exhausted to think about this now."
Isabeau rose to her feet.
"I'm not ready to sleep."
I smothered another yawn with the back of my hand. She eyed me speculatively, like a beautiful falcon scrutinizing a field mouse. Isabeau's glance turned mischievous.
"Get into bed, and I will tell you how I made Mathieu."
Her offer was too tempting to resist. I did as she told me while she pulled up a chair, and Mart busied herself with dishes and towels.
"So, where do I begin?"
She drew herself straighter in the chair and stared into the candle's flames.
"I cannot begin simply with my part of the story, but must start with his birth here in the village. I remember him as a baby, you know. His father and mother came when Philippe decided to build on this land back when Clovis was king. That's the only reason the village is here. It was where the farmers and the craftsmen who built the church and castle lived."
"Why did your husband pick this spot?" I leaned against the pillows, my knees folded close to my chest under the bedclothes.
"Clovis promised him the land in hopes it would encourage Philippe to fight against the king's rivals. My husband was always playing both sides against the middle."
Isabeau smiled wistfully. "Very few people caught him at it, though." "Was Matthew's father a farmer?"
"A farmer?" Isabeau looked surprised. "No, he was a carpenter, as was Mathieu, before he became a stonemason."
A mason. The tower's stones all fit together so smoothly they didn't seem to require mortar, and there were the oddly ornate chimneys at the old lodge gatehouse that Mathieu had just let some craftsman try his hand at constructing. His long, slender fingers were strong enough to twist open an oyster shell or crack a chestnut. Another piece of Mathieu fell into place, fitting perfectly next to the warrior, the scientist, and the courtier. "And they both worked on the chateau?"
"Not this chateau," Isabeau said, looking around her. "This was a present from Mathieu, when I was sad over being forced to leave a place that I loved. He tore down the fortress his father had built and replaced it with a new one."
Her green and black eyes glittered with amusement.
"Philippe was furious. But it was time for a change. The first chateau was made of wood, and even though there had been stone additions over the years, it was a bit ramshackle."
My mind tried to take in the timeline of events, from the construction of the first fortress and its village in the 6th century to Matthew's tower in the 13th century.
Isabeau's nose crinkled in distaste.
"Then he stuck this tower onto the back when he returned home and didn't want to live so close to the family. I never liked it. It seemed a romantic trifle, but it was his wish, and I let him."
She shrugged. "Such a funny tower. It didn't help defend the castle. He had already built far more towers here than we needed."
Isabeau continued to spin her tale, seeming only partially in the 21st century.
"Mathieu was born in the village. He was always such a bright child, so curious. He drove his father mad, following him to the chateau and picking up tools and sticks and stones."
"Children learned their trades early then, but Mathieu was precocious. By the time he could hold a hatchet without injuring himself, he was put to work."
An 8-year-old Mathieu with gangly legs and grey-green eyes ran around the hills in my imagination.
"Yes," she smiled, agreeing with my unspoken thoughts. "He was indeed a beautiful child. A beautiful young man as well. Mathieu was unusually tall for the time, though not as tall as he became once he was a vampire."
"And he had a wicked sense of humor.
He was always pretending that something had gone wrong, or that instructions had not been given to him regarding this roof beam or that foundation. Philippe never failed to believe the tall tales Mathieu told him.
Isabeau's voice was indulgent.
Mathieu's first father died when he was in his late teens, and his first mother had been dead for years by then. He was alone, and we worried about him finding a woman to settle down with and start a family. And then he met Blanca.
Isabeau paused, her look level and without malice.
You cannot have imagined that he was without the love of women.
It was a statement, not a question. Mart shot Isabeau an evil look, but kept quiet.
Of course not, I said calmly, though my heart felt heavy. Blanca was new to the village, a servant to one of the master masons Philippe had brought in from Ravenna to construct the first church. She was as pale as her name suggested, with white skin, eyes the color of a spring sky, and hair that looked like spun gold. A pale, beautiful woman had appeared in my visions when I went to fetch Matthew's computer. Isabeau's description of Blanca fit her perfectly.
She had a sweet smile, didn't she? I whispered.
Isabeau's eyes widened.
Yes, she did.
I know. I saw her when Matthew's armor caught the light in his study. Mart made a warning sound, but Isabeau continued.
Sometimes Blanca seemed so delicate that I feared she would break when drawing water from the well or picking vegetables. My Mathieu was drawn to that delicacy, I suppose. He has always liked fragile things.
Isabeau's eyes flickered over my far-from-fragile form.
They were married when Mathieu turned 25 and could support a family. Blanca was just 19. They were a beautiful couple, of course. There was such a strong contrast between Mathieu's darkness and Blanca's pale prettiness. They were very much in love, and the marriage was a happy one. But they could not seem to have children. Blanca had miscarriage after miscarriage. I cannot imagine what it was like inside their house, to see so many children of your body die before they draw breath. I wasn't sure if vampires could cry, though I remembered the blood-stained tear on Isabeau's cheek from my earlier visions in the salon. Even without the tears, however, she looked now as though she were weeping, her face a mask of regret. Finally, after so many years of trying and failing, Blanca was with child. It was 531, such a year. There was a new king to the south, and the battles had started all over again. Mathieu began to look happy, as if he dared to hope this baby would survive. And it did. Lucas was born in the autumn, and was baptized in the unfinished church that Mathieu was helping to build. It was a hard birth for Blanca. The midwife said that he would be the last child she bore. For Mathieu, though, Lucas was enough. And he was so like his father, with his black curls and pointed chin and those long legs.
What happened to Blanca and Lucas? I asked softly. We were only 6 years from Matthew's transformation into a vampire. Something must have happened, or he would never have let Isabeau exchange his life for a new one. Mathieu and Blanca watched their son grow and thrive. Mathieu had learned to work in stone rather than wood, and he was in high demand among the lords from here to Paris. Then fever came to the village. Everyone fell ill. Mathieu survived. Blanca and Lucas did not. That was in 536. The year before had been strange, with very little sunshine, and the winter was cold. When spring came, the sickness came too, and carried Blanca and Lucas away.
Didn't the villagers wonder why you and Philippe remained healthy?
Of course. But there were more explanations then than there would be today. It was easier to think God was angry with the village, or that the castle was cursed, than to think that the Mangesang were living among them.
Mangesang? I tried to roll the syllables around in my mouth as Isabeau had.
It is the old tongue's word for vampire, blood-eater. There were those who suspected the truth and whispered by the fireside, but in those days, the return of the Ostrogoth warriors was a far more frightening prospect than the Mangesang overlord.
Philippe promised the village's protection if the raiders came back. Besides, we made it a point never to feed close to home, she explained primly. What did Matthew do after Blanca and Lucas were gone?
He grieved. Matthew was inconsolable. He stopped eating. He looked like a skeleton, and the village came to us for help. I took him food,
Isabeau smiled at Mart,
and made him eat and walked with him until he wasn't so restless. When he could not sleep, we went to church and prayed for the souls of Blanca and Lucas. Matthew was very religious in those days. We talked about heaven and hell, and he worried about where their souls were and if he would be able to find them again.
Matthew was so gentle with me when I woke up in terror. Had the nights before he'd become a vampire been as sleepless as those that came after? By autumn he seemed more hopeful. But the winter was difficult. People were angry and the sickness continued. Death was everywhere. The spring could not lift the gloom. Philippe was anxious about the church's progress, and Mathieu worked harder than ever. At the beginning of the second week in June, he was found on the floor beneath its vaulted ceiling. His